Hello and welcome to Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters, and today we'll examine a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin with an analysis of why inequality has gone up so much with Jared Bernstein, who was up until recently the chief economist and economic advisor to Vice President Joe Biden, executive director of the White House Task Force on the Middle Class, and a member of President Obama's economic team. We will discuss the Occupy movement as a countervailing force against income inequality and the impact that a crash of the euro will have on our already weak economy and next year's elections. Then we will discuss the apparent opening up of Burma with the Secretary of State's visit and try to determine both the extent of political reform underway and the broader strategic role that the US is engaged in challenging Chinese influence in a brutalized country emerging from 50 years of oppressive military rule. A specialist on both Burma and Buddhism, Julianne Schober, the director of the Center for Asian Research at Arizona State University, joins us to look through a crack in the wall of repression that has ravaged this resource-rich, strategically important country. Then finally, we will discuss the just-released report by Amnesty International accusing Saudi Arabia of reacting to the Arab Spring by launching a wave of repression. The founder and director of the Center for Democracy and Human Rights in Saudi Arabia, Dr. Ali Al-Yami, joins us to examine the arrests of the mainly Shia Muslim restive in the mainly Shia Muslim restive eastern province and the fate of those that defy a permanent government ban on protests. Joining us now is Jared Bernstein, who's a senior fellow at the Center on Budget and Policy Priorities. From 2009 to 2011, he was the chief economist and economic advisor to Vice President Joe Biden, executive director of the White House Task Force on the Middle Class, and a member of President Obama's economic team. Prior to joining the Obama administration, Bernstein was a senior economist and the director of the Living Standards Program at the Economic Policy Institute in Washington, D.C. And between 1995 and 1996, he held the post of deputy chief economist at the United States Department of Labor. He's the author and co-author of numerous books, including Crunch, Why Do I Feel So Squeezed?, and 9 editions of The State of Working America. Welcome to Background Briefing, Jared Bernstein.
Well, thank you for inviting me on.
And you have a piece at the Huffington Post out now. Why has inequality gone up so much? And before we get the answers to that, just in terms of the political zeitgeist, it would seem that in your article you talk about the need for countervailing forces pushing it back against globalization and technological change. What's your take on the messaging that's come out of the Occupy movement, the 99% versus the 1%?
Well, first of all, let me emphasize and to some extent clarify that I'm not interested in pushing back against technological change or globalization. I'm interested in pushing back against their inequality-inducing effects. That is, it would be, I think, not in the interest of economic growth and improving living standards were we to try to stop the evolution of things like technology in our economy, which historically has been a very important booster to living standards. But without the proper countervailing forces, structures in place that give people more bargaining power such that they can reap some of the gains of economic growth that they themselves are helping to create, the benefits from technological change or globalization do an end run around the middle class. Your second question was about Occupy Wall Street. Yeah, so, I mean, I think it was funny. I was just looking at something before we started talking. Google has this function, Google, the web search tool, has this function where you can go in and ask, put down a couple of words, and it's called Google Trends, and see how often those words have come up in recent months. And I did this with income inequality, and I saw what I expected to see. I've been trying to introduce, elevate, amplify this problem for decades and have been hard-pressed to get a lot of lift. Occupy Wall Street in months has introduced this issue of income inequality, of opportunity, of the lack of opportunity, the lack of accountability, the lack of economic mobility into the discussion very effectively, very quickly. And for that, I think they deserve a lot of credit.
So I think in terms of the effects of Occupy Wall Street, I think it's gone way beyond those people in tents, many of whom, of course, have been removed, to a broader audience. But given the decades of government bashing that the political right in this country has done, and the extent to which there seemed to be a philosophy on the right in this country, in part grounded in this Ayn Rand notion that selfishness is a virtue, and that therefore the point is for individuals to gain as much for themselves as opposed to a sense of social responsibility. And I think the denigration of government over the decades has had its effect, I think, undoubtedly in this country. In many ways, it seems to me that the countervailing argument, which, of course, a part of the right's mantra is that we're taxed too much, it would seem to me that the argument could be turned around saying, well, it's not a question of how much you're taxed, which we happen to be taxed about the lowest in the world, almost. It's what you get back for your taxes. So is there any sense that in terms of building upon this new consciousness about inequality, it can go further into the reasons, as you have outlined in your article, why this inequality has grown? And in fact, the moral reasons, I guess, is what I'm getting at.
I do think so. I think the argument, as I suggested earlier, has a level of traction that it hasn't had in the past. In part, this has to do with the nature of our current economic dilemma. We sit in this country in a period of very high unemployment that we've been stuck with now for years. The recession, and while it may be waning on some official measures for many, I'd say probably most in the middle class and below, it still feels very much like a recession. Meanwhile, corporate profit rates have more than recovered, and they didn't get there on their own. They were helped by government bailouts. So the sense that the economy and the government is working for the benefit of the few and leaving many behind has the potential to have, I think, profound impacts among the American electorate. Now, the Tea Party, we know, has taken those kinds of sentiments and gone to a very anti-government place with them. Occupy Wall Street is different. While they're no fans of government, I think what they're targeting is the absence of opportunity and the absence of accountability. The failure of our economy, our society, to provide particularly young people with the opportunities they need to get ahead, or to hold some of the older people accountable for the way they screwed things up, motivates, I think, the movement. That's a pretty different kind of message. And ultimately, I suspect, and I even begin to see this morphing in that direction, I think not just the movement, but as you suggested, the kind of reverberations of the movement, the way the movement resonates beyond the camps, could very much move politics in a different and more progressive direction.
But it would seem, though, Jared Bernstein, that we need very, very strong and concerted arguments here to restore the very notion of government, which has been so maligned so effectively.
We need more than arguments. I think you're right. I think the problem is not just government's been maligned, it's that government has performed very badly. And in fact, it's a challenge to people like myself, who make arguments that an amply funded, efficient government is absolutely necessary in a complex, interconnected global economy like the one we have today that's prone to devastating market failures. To make that argument, you actually have to have you have to be worried about not just market failure, but government failure as well. And we've got an extremely dysfunctional federal government right now. I don't think there is any mistaking that. So that's a big piece, part of the puzzle, too.
Well, I've, just from my anecdotal reporting of late, particularly on the Occupy movement, two things come out. One is that this kind of libertarianism that we're talking about is starting to gain traction with the young, and that the young who flocked to Obama in 2008 may well be susceptible to this. And secondly, that the Occupy movement is, in many of the people I've spoken to, quite hostile to the Democratic Party. And they just feel that our money-driven politics have captured both parties, and they don't see a difference between the two parties. So again, it would seem to be a pretty high bar here to reignite a sense that this movement which is out there can be translated into politics, because I fear that all this energy may not be translated into electoral politics because these young people don't feel they have a place to go.
There's a risk of that, for sure. But I've spoken to some of the folks involved in the movement. I did a pretty long interview with someone from OWS that should be posted somewhere on one of their websites. And my sense from her and a couple of other folks I've talked to is that they're in this for the long game. I think that your description is a very accurate one of the near term. But if you're truly part of a populist movement that is, I think, very rightly concerned about the absence of opportunity, the absence of accountability, the sharp increases in income inequality, and the diminished mobility that kids face, even kids with college educations, ultimately, and the history of our country is extremely robust in the example I'm about to give, ultimately, there needs to be political and policy solutions. I think you're right to say that the movement is frustrated by the current politics, but I think it's absolutely the case, historically, that it's going to take public policy to address the injustices that they've identified. So they've got to be in this, if that's going to happen, they've got to be in this for the long game.
Again, I'm speaking with Jared Bernstein, who's a senior fellow at the Center on Budget and Policy Priorities. And from 2009 to 2011, he was the chief economist and economic advisor to Vice President Joe Biden, executive director of the White House Task Force on the Middle Class, and a member of President Obama's economic team. So I guess the question then is, will Occupy Wall Street occupy the elections? And so far, there's no evidence, at least from the people that I've talked to. What's your sense, though, of the broader electoral landscape that's shaping up here for the president who you served up until recently? My sense is that paradoxically you could make the case that President Obama's re-election fortunes are in the hands of Angela Merkel, because if the Europeans don't get their act together in the next week to stop the bleeding on the mounting debt crisis, there will be a crash there which will resonate across here and, of course, around the globe. And the poor economy that the president is running against would turn into a major millstone around his neck.
It is true that if Europe fails to get their act together pretty soon, I'm talking about the Eurozone in particular, the 17 countries that use the same currency, the euro, it could lead to a dip back into recession over there, particularly if some countries leave the Eurozone in a disorderly manner. I mean, you have to think about the very difficult implications of a country leaving a currency zone. I mean, basically, the way I described it in the blog the other day was, imagine you lent $1,000 to your neighbors, the Newmans, and you were expecting to be paid back $1,100 or something. Let's say you asked for 10% interest a year later, and a year later the Newmans came back and paid you back in $1,100 of a new currency called Newmans instead of dollars. Think about that, and you'll get a feel for what we're talking about here. That the impact on the American economy, which is already shaky, would obviously be negative. But there's a difference between a disorderly crash and one that's managed. If you think about Lehman, the investment bank that went down, obviously very disorderly and unexpected crash by many. If you think about the bankruptcy, on the other hand, of General Motors and Chrysler, very carefully managed by the government, quite different. So part of this is yet to be seen. I think on the electoral front, a lot of the president's fortunes will have to do with whether the unemployment rate is starting to come down, and that has something to do with policy measures that are currently under discussion. The unemployment insurance benefits need to be extended. There's a payroll tax cut holiday on the docket. So we'll have to see. I'd say it's early days, but it's not going to be an easy lift for an incumbent in a tough economy, no question about it.
But Jared Bernstein, when you mentioned the Lehman Brothers event, as it was called, in order to stop the global economy tanking and to rescue Wall Street, the Fed stepped in, pledging something to the extent of $29 trillion. Conversely, as my understanding is that the Europeans, in terms of building a firewall against the crash of the euro, they've only put up, as far as I know, €500 billion, and the European Stabilization Fund that they've set up has asked for about $1 trillion and has so far not even reached that mark.
How many trillion euros?
Sorry, trillion euros, yeah.
Yeah, that That 29 sounds awfully high, but I'm not.
Well, it's been quoted to me by a couple of economists.
Certainly there's no question that the Federal Reserve really put the pedal to the metal on this one and tried to flood the system with liquidity when that was what was needed, aggressively buying debt that banks were holding in order to increase their capital reserves and to relieve them of the impact of the non-performing loans that they were holding. Very, very aggressive and I think ultimately very important and successful work by the Federal Reserve. And by that I mean not that they were out of the woods, but that they certainly, I think, broke the back of a devastating financial meltdown. The ECB, the European Central Bank, simply hasn't done that yet. There are arguments that the ECB has a different mandate, that they're not really the lender of last resort, that they can't intervene. There's technical reasons they can't intervene as aggressively as the Fed. I think that's all just excuses and window dressing. There are lots of ways the ECB could do what needs to be done with the firepower of a magnitude that's needed, yet they're still kind of tilting against inflationary concerns at a moment when, you know, the ship is kind of heading toward an iceberg. So these are, I think, scary times for Europe. And the reason you have a central bank is expressly for times like, not just for times like this, but the reason you have a central bank that has emergency powers and that is insulated from the politics that make it quite difficult for some of the European leaders to do what needs to be done. You know, their populaces hate bailouts just as much, even more than ours do. So you could argue that their hands are somewhat tied, but that's why you have a central bank. And so we really need the ECB to step up here.
Well, this is, in fact, I think, an argument against Ron Paul and company, isn't it? They want to get rid of the Fed, you know, both on the libertarian right and on some parts of the progressive left are against the Fed. It's the absence of a mechanism that seems to be paralyzing the Europeans. But my understanding is that they have the resources, but they don't have the capability.
Yeah, I mean, I think that's right. I mean, and by the way, when we're talking about the Fed or the ECB, the Federal Reserve was printing money, and that can be a dangerous and unwise thing to do in an economy that's fully functional, up and running, where unemployment is very low, or it can be a very effective way of helping to offset the liquidity trap that we've been stuck in. And I think the Fed here has done the right thing. Look, Ron Paul and others who make that argument are very much beset by a kind of an ideology that is, as you suggested, very, very much libertarian, but I think at its root, you know, doesn't like an institution with this much influence that is unelected. And I understand that. I get that sentiment. There's a certain logic to it. However, I'm much more of a realist, and I think what's gotten this country into great difficulty, great trouble, and we'll get into much bigger trouble if we listen to people like Ron Paul, is to be guided by ideology instead of pragmatics and a real clear-eyed, hard-nosed look at what's going on. And we should have learned the lesson in the Great Depression that the absence of an aggressive central bank at a time when there's massive market failure is a recipe for unemployment that's unimaginably high. It was 25-30% in the Great Depression. That's where that kind of thinking will lead us if we pay attention to it.
Well, just in closing, Jared Bernstein, do you think that I understand the Italian Prime Minister warned that after the European summit next week, if they don't get their act together, there'll be no more room to maneuver. The deadline is December the 10th, which is looming. If they don't get their act together, it would seem to me that there could be a substantial shredding of the European social democracy. They have a much more developed social safety net than we do. There's also, of course, an unfortunate history of right-wing extremism in Europe, and we know that there's been evidence of growing influence of right-wing parties in Europe, or growing attraction, and there's Islamophobia and xenophobia loose on the continent. Give us a sense of how one, that might play out, and two, again, the follow-on to the United States, because here we are, have an administration that's trying to bring about something akin to a healthcare reform, not quite up to the standards of the Europeans, but at least an attempt in that direction. And what do you think the impact will be if this reversal takes place?
Well, I don't think it necessarily has to spell the end of the more progressive social safety net or system of social protections that some of the European countries have maintained. I mean, some of those countries, Scandinavia, Denmark, the Netherlands, France, Germany, well, maybe not France, but because they're facing some trouble too, but Germany, these are countries that are doing pretty well, or very well. Denmark's another, if I mentioned that, a good example of a country that, not in the Eurozone, but interestingly, they peg their currency to the euro and have maintained a pretty healthy economy coming out of the bust and a fairly robust welfare state. So I don't see any reason why that has to change. In fact, if anything, the restrictions that are being discussed about that are being discussed now in terms of the fiscal policies that you have to agree to if you want to stay in the European in the Eurozone look far more strict than some of the practices and social welfare systems I just described. So, you know, that's not obvious to me. I think the problem is a very fundamental one. You can't have a monetary union that's not a fiscal union, or at least they haven't figured out how to do that yet. There's reasons for that that have to do with, I would argue, some of the very feckless kinds of fiscal behavior we saw, like in Greece, but also there are macroeconomic adjustments that make it very tough. For example, for your currency to depreciate so you can export more if you have the same currency as other countries that are much, much stronger than you. So that's been a problem as well. So, I think that the transition, as I mentioned earlier with the example about the neighbor paying you back in a different currency than you lent them, I think the transition out of the Eurozone for some of these countries is going to be tremendously difficult and could be wrenching. But I don't think that, I don't necessarily see anything like a disaster scenario on the other side.
Well, I thank you for joining us here today, Jared Bernstein.
My pleasure.
Again, I've been speaking with Jared Bernstein. He's a senior fellow at the Center on Budget and Policy Priorities. From 2009 to 2011, he was the chief economist and economic advisor to Vice President Joe Biden, executive director of the White House Task Force on the Middle Class, and a member of President Obama's economic team. Prior to joining the Obama administration, Bernstein was a senior economist and director of the Living Standards Program at the Economic Policy Institute in Washington, D.C. He also held the post of deputy chief economist at the U.S. Department of Labor, and is the author and co-author of numerous books, including Crunch, Why Do I Feel So Squeezed?, and 9 editions of The State of Working America. We're going to take a brief station break and we'll be back talking about Secretary of State Hillary Clinton's visit to Burma.